The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Live from the Space Talk Radio Studios, it's The Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting live to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy, here's the founder and host of The Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to the Tuesday Space Show program. Welcome to all of you in Seattle who are listening on KKNW. Thank you for being here tonight. A couple of quick announcements and the introduction to the show, and then I am really happy to bring to you two of my very, very favorite guests, one who's been away from the Space Show for far too long, but it's really great to have Jim Pass and Al Harrison back with us. First of all, a couple of very quick announcements. For those of you who would like to call the program, the toll-free line will be open after the first break, and that number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring until it can be answered, and then you will be patient until we can bring you up on the air. If you're using email, it is either drspace@thespaceshow.com, dmlivings@yahoo.com, or thespaceshow@gmail.com. And for chat, if you're using Instant Messenger, ICQ, or CompuServe, the screen name is the same. One word, Space Show Chat. Remember, the Space Show is a trademark and service mark for me. It's an educational program. We don't endorse anybody's business venture or their ideas or anything like that. We're just here to put the information and the education out there and to hopefully spark good debates and good interest. And remember that I also have the copyright, so you're more than welcome to download these shows, put them on CD, share them, burn them, pass them around. Anything you want to get the message out, just don't do anything commercial and don't change or audit the text of any of the interviews. And our deep space message is ending, so today is the last day for it. And if you want to be the first to send a deep space message into 207, read about it on our website, thespaceshow.com. It's up at the top, and then get your entry in very, very quickly. And at our website, thespaceshow.com, our comprehensive newsletter is there. It's uploaded every Monday, modified during the week as necessary. It shows all the coming events planned for the Space Show, plus important announcements during the week will show up there. If you want just the short form emailed to you that tells you what's happening during any given week, please send a request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. We'll be happy to enter your subscription. That is also emailed out on Monday. Everything we do is archived, MP3 format, and podcast. It's all on the website going back almost 6 years now. Check out the Space Show store. You'll see a link for that on our website. Hopefully you'll find some items of interest there. And also remember that the Space Show is a nonprofit 501c3. We're affiliated with One Giant Leap Foundation, and we do need your support and your help. It's a big undertaking to be doing things in space. Ask any of the people on this show who are building rockets or have a space venture about the challenges to go into space. Well, it's just as challenging, just as costly in its own way, and just as difficult to do the Space Show. So we appreciate your support, and all of you who do support us, thank you very much. And the same to all of you who will be supporting us in the future, because we have two fabulous guests tonight. I'm going to pass on hold the dates. We'll do that when we come back tomorrow morning. By the way, I do want to point out we have a tomorrow morning show with Sam Dinkin, 9:30 a.m. Pacific Time, a tomorrow evening show. Richard Hoagland is returning to the Space Show, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Wednesday night, and then our Friday and Sunday show, as always. So let me tell you about our two guests today. First, it's really an honor to welcome back Dr. Al Harrison to the program. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about him, and I'm going to post his full bio on the website when I archive the show. But Al received his BA and MA in psychology from UC Santa Barbara and his doctorate in social psychology from the University of Michigan. In 1967, he joined the faculty of the Department of Psychology at UC Davis, and in 1979, he advanced to professor of psychology. He is now professor emeritus. He is the author or co-author of about 100 papers in a wide range of professional journals. His books include Living Aloft, Human Requirements for Extended Space Flight, From Antarctica to Outer Space, Life in Isolation and Confinement, After Contact, The Human Response to Extraterrestrial Life, Spacefaring, The Human Dimension, and his recent book, Starstruck, Cosmic Visions in Science, Religion, and Folklore, is soon going to be published by Bergen Books in May of this year. Starstruck describes how new scientific findings about our place in the universe are encouraging people to find new answers to old existential questions. He also is a big player with Human Factors and SETI, and I'll let you read the rest of his information on the website. I will say that if you watch certain documentaries on the History Channel, you will see Al. He's in several of them dealing with extraterrestrial visitors, UFOs, and other subjects that the History Channel handles very, very well. And Al's documentaries have a long life, and they're still playing them quite often on the History Channel. We also get to have with us tonight Dr. Jim Pass. And Jim received his PhD in sociology from USC with a specialty in deviance, which I guess is pretty good for the space community. I'm going to ask him about that tonight. He became increasingly uninterested about the topic as he got closer and closer to graduation. And then he got interested in both sociology and space exploration, and he put the two together after reading Alan Toff's web article entitled Positive Consequences of SETI Before Detection, in which he made a comment about creating something called social astronomy or astrosociology. And you can read about Jim's work, but Jim is probably the leader in developing the astrosociology field. We're going to talk to him about that. It's great to have both Dr. Pass and Dr. Harrison with us. Welcome, Al, and welcome, Jim. How are you both?
Thank you, David. Thank you. I'm fine, and it's a great pleasure to be on your show again.
Great. Jim, give us a working definition before we go to our first break with KKNW. What are we going to consider as astrosociology for this evening?
Okay, astrosociology is the application of the social sciences to space exploration. So one way to look at it is the study of what I call astrosocial phenomena, which are social and cultural patterns related to space.
And let's give out your website, because you have a great website for astrosociology. What is your URL again?
It's www.astrosociology.com.
Okay, and Al, we still have some time before the break. Do you have anything you'd like to add to that definition?
No, but I would like to say that I think Jim is showing real leadership in trying to mobilize the intellectual community to work on this. There's a level of organization, enthusiasm, and motivation which I haven't seen before, even though there's long been a need for some way of catalyzing different people working in these areas to help one another out and make mutual progress. So I'm very enthusiastic, and actually I envy Jim, because I think he's making some progress that I would like to have made, and I'm very happy to help him with astrosociology.
Jim or Al, is the field finally growing and developing? Jim, you've been talking about this, I believe, for about 2 years on the space show, and you had a terrific working group that was assembled at Space 2006 in San Jose. I think you had about 15, 20 people in the room, and I see there's even more on the email distribution list. Would you categorize the effort and the movement as growing and becoming more widely accepted?
I would say within the AAAA, which is where we had our group meeting, it's moving ahead pretty well. We have a lot of people that are social scientists, but also people who are engineers and, you know, space scientists and so on, who are interested in looking at the sociological and social science, you know, perspectives when looking at space, and not just, you know, the physical science aspect of it. And I think one of the toughest things that I see is really within the social sciences. While there are some people who are interested, most of them are interestingly young people, which is kind of good, I guess. But the older crowd seems to be pretty reluctant, pretty resistant to, you know, astrosociology, at least in sociology. Some of the other social sciences I'm not as familiar with, because I'm not an anthropologist, for example, but in sociology, there, you know, it's a tough road. But we are making some progress at the regional level, which is probably what we have to do first. You know, become successful at the regional level, and then move into the national.
Okay, let's hold it right there. We're going to take our first break for KKNW. When we come back, I want to continue with this line of thinking, but I also, for you both, would like to break the space movement down into different categories and see what you think of astrosociology within the various segments of the space community. So everybody stay right where you are. We'll be back with Al Harrison and Jim Pass in 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is your host of The Space Show, David Livingston. Our guests today, Al Harrison and Jim Pass. So, gentlemen, if we look at space and we say there is a big category called NASA and a big category called the large aerospace industry and the big contractors, and then we have an emerging industry with the entrepreneurs, the guys trying to do space tourism, getting us into space with sort of new space ventures. Where do you see people thinking about astrosociology issues? Is it coming from NASA? Is it coming from the large community? Where does it come from?
Could I comment on NASA, since I've been working with them?
Absolutely, Al.
For about 30 years.
Uh-huh.
And I need to add that when I think of astrosociology, I'm referring not just to things that have that, activities that have that very specific label, but related kinds of activities, you know, studies and applications and so forth that have to do with psychology, sociology, anthropology, and recognizing that the term astrosociology is relatively new and not that well known in a lot of quarters. I would say that NASA has a profound ambivalence in some ways about these kinds of factors. That if we look back to 1960 up to the present, that there's intermittent interest in how people will respond to living conditions in space. They have certainly sponsored quite a bit of behavioral research over the years, but it's only been in the last 10 years or so that I think they've really rolled their sleeves up and gotten into the what you might call softer human factors, the kinds of questions that are asked by social psychologists, sociologists, anthropologists, organizational experts, those kinds of things. And in fact, in the early part of this decade, there was quite a bit of momentum growing behind a field known as behavioral health. NASA sponsored a conference on that. I was lucky enough to be the principal investigator, and we really made a lot of progress and published a special issue of Aviation, Space, and Environmental Medicine, which laid it all out. And that was right about the time that it became obvious that the crew exploration vehicle was going to have to be moved along a little bit faster to replace the shuttle. And with the massive reassignment of funds, astro-sociological or behavioral kinds of research was once again eclipsed. It's a very complicated kind of relationship between people in the social and behavioral sciences, to some extent medicine, and NASA. And a lot of thorny issues have to be worked out before those of us who are in these fields become consistent players who get good results. But I would say that the shift has been in the direction of greater recognition of this kind of activity. Funding is tough all over.
Yeah, absolutely. Funding is tough, but why is there such a resistance or a reluctance to embrace issues embedded in astrosociology? If we're talking about settlement in space or a long-term space flight to Mars, or we're even talking about putting tourists on an orbiting hotel for a week or 2 weeks, these human factors are going to be blasting at us in our face. I don't understand the resistance to embracing them now so we know what we're getting into.
The resistance, I think, comes from other kinds of factors, that there is a recognition, you know, that these will be important in future spaceflight, but we're not engaged in this future spaceflight. We should be doing the research and getting things ready now, but, you know, it's still off in the future somewhere. The kinds of things that have tended to work against human factors, again, or we might call them life factors, in NASA, are such things as competing priorities for money, concern about public image. You know, certainly, public relations and politics have always been important to NASA to get the funding to do the basic things that they want to do. Problems of communication between people who are involved in behavioral research and some of the NASA engineers, differences between these two cultures. And, you know, the list can go on and on, and it's simply a matter of being persistent and picking away at it. I will simply say that since becoming involved in this sort of thing, humans in space exploration, in the late 1970s, three times I felt I was flying high, and three times I was waiting for the phone to ring. So it sort of cycles in and out, but it's got to be addressed before we make a return to the moon and move on to Mars.
Al, Jim mentioned that within the community and the subsets of the sociology community, there's also resistance. So what about your peers up at UC Davis and within the academic institutions? Are you seeing a shift toward accepting this topic in the space field, or is it still sort of, you know, the outcast child?
Okay, there's a couple of answers to this. There have been a fair number of psychologists, certainly fewer, but some anthropologists and sociologists working with NASA on these topics. So it's not like that's totally unheard of. There is a fairly extensive literature, aviation, space, environmental medicine, is one of the major repositories for this literature. But I would say that it's considered a little bit oddball and unusual. It's not part of mainstream psychology. It's okay, but it's not where the action is, which is, to me, stuff that's not particularly interesting and exciting. Now, the other part to this, I think, is what happens if you become a spacey when you're an academic and you're on a campus. And here I want to refer not only to humans in space, which has some immediate credibility, but also more iffy efforts, such as astrobiology study, working on the psychological side of those, and now planetary defense, the protection of Earth from asteroid and comets. And this is indeed far from the mainstream. It's hard to get people involved, interested. I was very lucky and my peers, the dean, indeed the chancellor of the campus, always supported my efforts. I think that a couple of things played into it, and not the least of which was that I was just about a full professor at the time I got started. It's a little bit dicey, but you can get by. I would certainly give warnings to assistant professors starting out in academia about focusing on something like SETI.
I want to get to Jim and see how he divides up astrosociology and the divisions of the space community, but this message just came in, and it's right on top of what you were just saying, Al, so I'll bring it up. And this is Christine in Santa Ana, and she says, I'm a frequent listener to the Space Show, and I know, Dr. Livingston, you don't do the UFO topic. You refer people to Coast and other all-night paranormals. But I have seen your guest, Dr. Harrison, on the History Channel many, many times over the last couple of years on the UFO documentaries that he has done. They are splendid, and that is why the History Channel keeps repeating them. Dr. Harrison, have you taken academic hits for being on those History Channel UFO documentaries? I hear that this is an absolutely forbidden topic for academics to handle, yet there you are on History Channel television fairly often during any given year talking about UFOs and related issues. Has it hurt you academically?
No, not in the least. But you have to remember that I'm a psychologist, and I'm talking about why people believe in UFOs and what UFO experiences can do to people. I'm not presenting evidence for the reality of UFOs. I'm not claiming that the government is covering up a lot of material. So I'm doing real psychology on this. I am very interested in UFOs as a sociocultural phenomenon. I think that both the true believers and the knee-jerk skeptics have got it wrong. I think it is a profound social movement, and I think it's part of coming to grips with our place in the universe. So I've been willing to think, talk, read, and work on UFOs, and my book that will be coming out in May is going to talk about the whole field of ufology in this large scheme of things. I'm probably unique, and I also know that this interest has the potential of alienating my good friends who are in SETI or astrobiology. But frankly, if you're thinking about life in the universe and how people view this and so forth, ignoring ufology, ignoring UFOs, is sort of like not paying attention to an elephant in the dining room. So I feel it needs to be looked at and worked on.
Jim, tell us how astrosociology divides out in the space community. I mean, we've talked with Al a little bit about NASA, but what happens? Are the big companies that are building the hardware that repair the space station, that take the shuttle up there, do they address these issues? Have you seen much of it in the entrepreneurial side of the community?
I've seen individuals within the companies who are interested in astrosociological issues and social science issues related to space. The companies themselves, I think, are more profit and practical in their orientation. So I don't think they're really looking into it. But in terms of, you know, just going back to NASA real quick, I think what I've seen with NASA is a lot of the employees, you know, for example, in our working group, we have some people from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and some of the other centers. And, you know, I've seen some individuals, you know, even space scientists talk about the cultural implications of their work and the social implications of their work. The problem is we don't have anybody who's scientifically looking at this stuff to do the research. We're just, you know, talking, we're just listening to speculation by scientists who are in a different field. So that's why I think, you know, that's why I think our effort to try to get the interested social scientists together into one field so we can collaborate instead of doing things in isolation will help us to get more credibility.
I, as you know, teach as an adjunct at the Space Studies Department at the University of North Dakota, which is a multidiscipline program, and the students graduate with a Master's of Science. And they do human factors, but it's all about the technology and the hard medical side and the engineering of human factors. And I teach business and ethics and management type of classes, and they have some people that teach the hard engineering side of human factors, you know, radiation, that type of thing. And then, of course, they have astronomers, and they have planetary geophysicists and other sciences there. This subject is not represented and not taught and not part of a multi-disciplined curriculum, not at all. And I don't think I've ever heard it mentioned on campus. And Jim, you know Dr. Sade, who's there in space policy side, on the government side, not brought up, not mentioned. How is it dispersed throughout the space academic community or the universities that do have various aspects of space sciences, space studies, space engineering? Are they starting to bring this field into their students, or is it still something that is rare if we find it in academia?
I think it's rare, but I would like to see it come about in astronomy departments. I'd like to see them have an astrosociology course, just so they can get an aspect of the, you know, a strong feeling for the social and cultural implications, and not just, you know, the astronomical science point of view. And within sociology, you know, I want to, and also the other social sciences, I'd like to see courses taught in astrosociology. Right now in sociology, for example, space is a taboo, you know. When I go to the national organization meetings, I feel like, you know, I'm in isolation. You know, I feel like an outcast. Because as soon as you mention space to them, they kind of look at you funny. And they back away, you know. So I think for some people within, and probably the, you know, the gatekeepers within sociology at the national level, there is some work that needs to be done to convince them of the importance of what we're doing.
Interesting. Gentlemen, we're going to do our next break, and everybody, we will be back in 2 minutes. Our guests today, Dr. Harrison and Dr. Pass. Everybody, stay where you are.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, Your gift to the space show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back, everybody. Our guest today, Dr. Al Harrison and Dr. Jim Pass. And gentlemen, I've got some questions that I'm going to field right about now. And this is from Marshall in Saxey, Texas. He says, NASA limits people on the space station to 6 months. That is about the same amount of time as the Navy's at-sea mission. Is there a sociological reason for a six-month mission?
Good question. I think probably they're trying to avoid any problems associated with the longer stay, psychological and social. The separation from loved ones and friends and so on, and just the things they expect every day to have available on the space station can cause some problems. So I think they're just trying to avoid, that kind of thing. And, if you think about it, if they bring them down in 6 months, people, the astronauts know they're coming back at that time, and they don't have to worry about doing research in sociological areas.
Yeah, my additional, I think Jim got a lot of it, got most of it right there, but I'd add a couple of points. I think there's a shifting roughly at the end of 1 month from it being sort of a sojourn to actually living in space. We have to keep in mind, of course, that the Russians, they've had people in space much longer than 6 months, that it's going to require a lot longer than 6 months for Mars, and it may be very unduly expensive to bring people back from the moon after 6 months. Certainly, it minimizes some risks, perhaps, such as radiation exposure. But I think one of the things we need to think of here is it provides motivation for astronauts in the sense that if you let one person stay up there for a couple of years, that's other astronauts who are never going to get to fly. We have an interesting kind of a situation where we have I don't know the size of the astronaut corps, but we're certainly providing only limited access to space. And whereas you want to have a really good person up there, the best person, I also need to give other people a chance, too. So there may be lots of different factors that make the six-month mission attractive.
Marshall and anyone else listening who is really interested in this, I did a program, I believe it's around May of 2006, with a UND professor, Dr. Vadim Regolov, who's a physicist from Russia, but was very much involved in the Soviet Union space program. And he came on because, first of all, Al, he really knows the UFO field in Russia. And he talks to me very, very privately about it and how serious it is and what goes on with it, but never to his classes and never publicly. But we have a thing there where we talk about it. But he had access to the information and was part of some of the very long-term duration Soviet space flights. And he came on the show, and I think he did more than 2 hours, and he talked about what happened to Soviets that got involved in long-term space flights. And he said that 3 months was about the point where they started to disassociate from Earth. And when they were really out there 5 months, 6 months, 7 months, they had to develop unbelievable programs to keep them sane. And he said what they had to do was keep them in radio contact with Earth, with their family members, on a really regular daily basis, so that they wouldn't let them mentally, and you guys probably know more about this than me, disassociate, because the longer they were in space on these long missions, the more disassociation from Earth they went through, and the more incapable of doing their mission and their work they became. And they had major problems with this disassociation and this and absolutely not being able to do their jobs, and in fact challenging their sanity. And he said the Soviets had problems. They really worked hard to keep in contact and keep them connected to Earth, and through everything that they could possibly think of to get them to relate to Earth, so that they didn't make the break and disassociate from being here on Earth. And about 3 months was the point where it started happening. And when they got out to 5, 6 months, 7 months, it was major, major problems for them to keep them sane on a mission. I don't know if either of you have any comment about that.
Yeah, I have a comment on that, that this is the kind of stuff that doesn't really make the literature. You can talk to operational psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, people who work with astronauts, cosmonauts, and, you know, the best you're going to get is veiled allusion to problems, and there's a number of different reasons for this. One is medical confidentiality, another is public relations. You know, third is, do we really want to, have people develop negative attitudes towards these people who are representing us in space and doing the best they can? I'll simply say that this is somebody I hope I meet someday, and I would love to put them in the mix if I hear of another conference where these issues are...
Well, I'll introduce you.
Exactly what needs to be out there.
I will, after the show, send Vadim an email and to both of you and introduce you. You guys would really, really enjoy him. And you know, all I can say is, and I've said this at conferences to people, especially in the new space world, when we talk about we're going to have these settlements on the moon and we're going to be going to Mars and doing all this, if we don't figure out how to address these issues and talk about them and plan for them, we're going to have catastrophes on our hand if these missions ever get launched and these issues are not dealt with and addressed. I do not think that what happened with the Soviet cosmonauts on these longer-term missions is unique to a Russian. I think this is going to happen to all of us, and probably we civilians who get to go, who are not as well trained as a military person being an astronaut or a cosmonaut, are probably going to be more susceptible to these kinds of issues than the highly trained people. And yet it is not talked about. Jim, you know, we've been at places together, and it doesn't get the airing that it should get. And I think it's right up there with how to get lower launch costs. Because, you know, what are we going to do? Launch mentally deficient people into space and have total psychological breakdown up there just because we have cheap launches? I mean, it's a package deal. You got to have sanity along with the engineering and the physics and the sciences.
Can I comment on that?
Sure, go ahead, Jim.
I was just going to say there's a few published articles. With one of the leaders is Dr. Nick Canis, who's down at UC, University of California, San Francisco. And he works with a lot of Russian collaborators. In fact, it's conceivable. What did you say this person's name was up at North Dakota?
Vadim Regalov. He's a professor there in the physics department.
Okay, it's not one of his collaborators. And they talk about some of these things, but, oh, boy, is it ever... soft pedal, I guess that's the way I would put it. You know, and if you're not aware of problems, you don't understand their magnitude, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble, a lot of hot water. So there's a group of people that have been, you know, pushing on this for years, and I suspect that at some point that things will be put in place. I really need to add that there are some wonderful people down at Johnson Space Center. Working operationally with the astronauts and their families, providing psychological support services. I think, you know, they're very dedicated, very talented, and I think very effective. However, what we need is, you know, more research so we can come up with new and better countermeasures to deal with new emissions. But I would hate to leave the impression that nobody was doing anything about this.
No, I think the big professional space community is very aware of this. You know, whether it gets out of that community and gets into the literature and gets disseminated into more or less the private parts of the space community, that's probably the issue I'm talking about.
I'm not sure they know what to do with it.
No, I think it needs a lot of research and study, and they need to pay very careful attention to it and how to deal with it. And, you know, I'm sure that every time these guys and gals go up there, they're collecting more and more data on how to deal with these kinds of issues, especially if they're going to be up there for a long time.
But I think, you know, one of the problems is that, you know, my argument is, you know, for one thing, that the social environment is just as important as the physical environment. Even if the habitat sustains people biologically, it doesn't mean that the population is going to survive. And my argument is that what we should do is that we should not only transfer people into space, but we should transfer culture and social structure along with them, so that there's, you know, what I call a space society or a settlement. But I call it a space society because what you want to do is you want to replicate society in space rather than having a crew, which doesn't really have what I would consider the proper social structure for a long-term survival. I think we need to probably send more people rather than fewer people and, you know, create something more like what we have on Earth, something more familiar.
I have another question for you. This is from Bill in Virginia. Either of you can address it, or both of you can. Bill says, I am constantly surprised and dismayed by the venom and vendettas associated with questioning the tenets by some alt-spacers. Attempting to question or debate some of their assumptions results in immediate ad hominem attacks. How does this contribute to advancing commercial spaceflight? Furthermore, if these are the people who claim to be taking us into space, is our effort going into space tragically dysfunctional? Your comments, please.
Jim, you want to go first?
Well, you know, some of these groups do have problems in that area, and I think that dysfunction is not a good organizational model for moving into space or anywhere else. And I think, you know, that there has to be something more cooperative put into place rather than what we have now in a lot of these areas.
Well, I would say that a lot of groups are, they tend to be small. Sometimes they merge, form bigger groups, but then they split up, something like churches where half the members want one thing, half the members want another thing. And because they never reach critical mass, that's one of the reasons that so many of them tend to be ineffective or disappear in fairly short order. I think that one of the things that feeds some of this, and I agree that ad hominem attacks and venom vitriol conflict, and in fact they're not getting us into space, they're not contributing there, as I'm sure the person who sent the question knows, they're making a negative kind of contribution. But that there was a wonderful book written by Howard McCurdy called Space and the American Imagination. And what he pointed out was that the some of the great space visionaries of the 50s and 60s spun these wonderful tales illustrated with these fabulous realistic paintings showed wonderful huge spaceships and neat and clean colonies and, you know, orbiting communities and so forth and so on, and sort of created this utopian vision which simply couldn't couldn't be met. And I suspect that the utopian vision is still maintained by a lot of people. Now, there are people out there, there are groups, there are private companies, including small companies, that are trying to take a realistic look at this. And there are a few money people to go along with the idea people. I have a little bit of a bias here, but I think that Bigelow Aerospace in Las Vegas has made some pretty tremendous strides over a short period of time, relatively short period of time, and that it's an effort that actually has some substance behind it and is using is trying to refine technology that was already out there. And, you know, so some of these companies, some of these organizations may eventually get somewhere, but my personal view and experience is that whereas it's fun to participate, too many of them have trouble making visible or measurable progress.
Well, I can tell you, when you and I were going to those conferences in Las Vegas during the summer, we had a blast together. But if you look back on what the conferences accomplished, it wasn't much, but we sure had fun, didn't we?
One of my thoughts from I think, that particular conference was, you know, people said, gee, this is great. We have 80 people. And I was thinking, man, if you're even going to budge, you're going to have 800 people. And that's just, you know, to ring the opening bell. You
know? I know. We went to dinner. We'd go to dinner at Caesar's Palace Forum, and there's more than 80 people in one little corner,
yeah.
You know, gathered around a nickel slot machine. Jimmy, you've got some conferences coming up with some papers you're going to present, right?
Right.
You want to tell us about that, please?
Yeah. The first one is STAFE in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Right. I've been doing hold the date for STAFE, so they should know what that is by now.
Okay. And I am presenting a paper about moon bases as initial space society trials. Basically, the thesis is that when we go to the moon, as soon as it's feasible, we should treat those bases as if they're isolated on Mars or even further away, and do some social science research to see how isolation affects the people living on the moon. Even though they're, you know, they could be rescued quickly, we should run a scenario where we treat them as if they're isolated and see how that works out. That way we can get some valuable data that I think would be a lot better to do here than, you know, waiting till we get to Mars to do it, where we can't rescue those individuals quickly enough, perhaps.
For those of us who can't make it to STAFE, how can we get a hold of your paper or see what you're saying on this? This is an interesting topic. I'd like to read your paper.
Okay. There's a page at my site called the Virtual Library. It's a button on the top of the site page,
uh-huh.
Called Virtual Library. Following the conference, I will, once they give me permission for the copyright, I'll post it.
Okay.
Right now, it's already posted as a reference, but there's no paper attached.
If you send me an email and let me know that it's up there, I will announce it on the show.
Great. Okay.
To remind. And then you have the Pacific Sociological Association. You're doing three papers or three sessions on astrosociology. But Al is too, right?
Allison, yeah. There's one astrosociology session, special session. They gave me permission to create a special session just dedicated to astrosociology. And Al's going to be presenting a paper in that particular one.
Yes, and in fact, Jim, the paper I'll be presenting will be the, addressing the whole problem of getting recognition within NASA and the major space companies for the kind of work that we're interested in.
That's good. That's great.
Make a call. Please hang up and.
So that one is, there's on the calendar page at my site. You can find the links to the Pacific.
Okay, and Al, if you. Tell me when that paper is available, and if it's available on a website or something, let me know. I'll announce it on air too.
It's available. I've got some sort of stacked projects, sort of like airplanes circling O'Hare right now, and so that one's going to be after I finish the paper for the planetary defense conference coming up at George Washington University in March. But I will certainly let you know where people can see it.
Okay.
And this might be a good juncture to simply mention to the listening audience that I'm always happy to take emails. I may not be able to answer questions, but if someone wants my views on something or thinks I can point them in a direction of a resource, I like to do it. And in fact, I find it more interesting and fun than dealing with university emails about this or that job that needs to be done. So, I was very happy to work with individual listeners. I found that it does not lead to, being totally swamped with hopeless inquiries and stuff, but leads to some interesting conversations.
Okay. Before we break from Seattle, let me see if I can get in these two questions. This is from John in Montana. If the alt space groups are small fractionated groups like splinter groups in a church, is space advocacy analogous to a religion with alt spacers as the true believers? What do you think about this?
I think it's the way I was referring to it, I was looking at it organizationally. Not in terms of a religion, but there are certainly plenty of scholars out there who see religious overtones in space exploration. And in fact, one of the chapters in my new book is of gods and spacemen, and it not only deals with superior forms of extraterrestrial life up there, but also astronauts and cosmonauts. And there are other people who have really pushed this idea. Roger Lonius, who's the chief historians at the National Air and Space Museum, is very fond of pointing to religious overtones in our quest to conquer space.
Here's another question. This is again from Marshall near Dallas, Texas. I remember the Apollo missions to the moon. There was something special when a large group of us watched Neil, Buzz, Jack, and the others bouncing around on the moon. We have 10 times the number of cameras to watch people on the space station, and it seems totally boring. What is the sociological difference?
Well, I think for the moon, it was something that was something new, and it was not even deemed possible by a lot of people before we actually did it, especially in the time frame that we had. And I think probably, on the space station, we've been there for a while now, and people are doing the same things on the space station. And it's orbiting the Earth. It's not going anywhere. So I think people are kind of getting used to the whole idea of the space station. And, I think we need to go somewhere else besides low Earth orbit to excite the population again.
Yeah, I concur with that. How about Baghdad, you guys? Will that excite us?
That's a comment. I think that it's easy to lose sight of the fact that space is still a very challenging environment that requires the best of the best people, and that includes the shuttle and the space station. But the most unkind way I heard the current space program referred to was generating the same excitement as watching, 16-wheel rigs go by on the interstate. I don't think it's that boring, but it certainly lacks the fire and enthusiasm and ability to capture the public mind as it did in those wonderful heady days that Marshall mentioned.
Absolutely, and hopefully we can do something that's more exciting and adventuresome and safer than going to Baghdad. But before we break in a couple of minutes from Seattle, the STEM education programs are pretty strong across the country, and NSF, does a lot of program for funding STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math. Astrosociology, the social sciences, they're not part of STEM education. Should they be? Should it be modified to include the social sciences?
I think they should. In fact, one of my papers for PSA is about bringing space into the social science classroom. The idea is, if it stimulates the imaginations of students, social science students aren't any different than any other student. So I would think that we should, we should target those kinds of students, especially those who declare, who are in, separate classes, obviously, but even older people who are declaring themselves as majors and so on. Why not bring in space into those classrooms? Because I think it would have the same effect. And if astrosociology is really going to take off, we need to have it. We need to have a structured classroom environment where space is part of their curriculum.
I concur. There's so many reports that says our STEM education is below par and below standards, especially if we look at the number of engineers, for example, that we're turning out compared to India and China. I guess I'm asking, is there room in STEM education to bring in the social sciences?
Well, I think, what it really is an expansion of the introduction of space or the use of space in the classroom. So, STEM itself would go on as it is, and you would basically expand it into the social science classroom. So that, maybe all these people don't want to be engineers, but there may be a lot of social scientists or budding social scientists who are interested in space and would like to take astrosociology as a major. So right now, they're not getting that option. And, as you said, when we start thinking about settlements, space settlements, and transforming societies into space-faring societies and things like that, planetary defense, those kinds of considerations, then I think we're talking about the need for social scientists to come in. We talked earlier about this idea of, why NASA is kind of has been pretty comfortable in leaving out the social sciences.
Jim, why don't you hold it right there, because I have to break from KKNW in Seattle, and we leave at the top of the hour. So I want to thank the listeners in Seattle for tuning us in tonight. We will be back on Seattle next Tuesday night. In the meantime, check out the rest of tonight's program on our website, thespaceshow.com. It will be archived and up in podcasting later this evening. And then again, our special programs tomorrow morning, tomorrow evening, our regular programming Friday and Sunday. We want to thank everyone from KKNW, and we look forward to joining you again on next Tuesday. Everybody, we will be right back with the Space Show and the special edition. Welcome back, everybody. This is a special edition of the Space Show. I'm your host, David Livingston. Our guest today, Drs. Al Harrison and Jim Pass. And Jim, we were in the middle of hearing you give us some good information before I broke for the break and cut you off. You want to finish what you were talking about?
Yeah, I was just saying that, one of the reasons I think why NASA has basically been comfortable without the social sciences is because they haven't really, except for psychology for the most part, they haven't really needed the social sciences. But now with, space settlements and planetary defense and, actually studying how societies are transforming themselves based on, space activities that are going to increase in time, I think even NASA is going to find that they're going to have to employ, astrosociologists eventually. And I think I've been getting some positive feedback from some people within NASA, not necessarily official channels, but unofficial channels about the need for going in this direction. So hopefully the future will bear that out.
The only thing I would disagree with Jim on is that I would say recognize the need, which is what he may have meant. And
what did I say?
You said have a need, but I think the need's always been there, and that's a
recognizing.
Yeah, question of recognition. And there have been places where psychologists have contributed, certainly, but I'll tell you where sociologists have contributed, and where NASA has in fact recognized it, and that is in terms of the analyses of Challenger and Columbia, where at least at one level the problem has been some kind of physical event, but at another level it's been blocked communications channels, misunderstanding, things like that, which sociologists such as Diane Vaughan have done a wonderful job of working with. And so I think there's many, many points of entree for astrosociologists into the world of space exploration.
It would seem to me that an incredible home for astrosociologists in the space world would be SETI. So who wants to talk about that? How is SETI, very receptive? Is it a good home for this discipline?
May I go first?
Yeah, it's your field, Al.
For about in SETI for about 15 years now, and one of the really wonderful, remarkable things is that the senior SETI people, people like Frank Drake and Jill Carter and earlier Morrison and Sagan, they recognize that this whole enterprise has tremendous psychological, sociological, and cultural significance, and they've welcomed with open arms, they've promoted and encouraged people which were lumped together under astrosociology to participate. One of the goals of the SETI committee of the International Academy of Astronautics was to recruit, to bring more people in. And right now there is a quote social scientist at the SETI Institute who's very active, promoting meetings and edited volumes. His name is Doug Vakoch. He's doing a great job there, juggling about a 10-ring circus. And I think one of the classes, actually, of academics that needs to have stronger representation is, in fact, sociology itself. There's two psychologists, maybe one or two more internationally, a fair number of anthropologists, but sociology needs stronger representation. And my gosh, it would be welcome within the SETI community, I'm sure.
I'll work on that.
Doug, of course, has been on the show a long time ago. I think it might be time to see if he wants to come back on.
He has a lot of new stuff going on that I think might interest people. And one of the things is this tremendous push in anthropology. There's been three presentations at American Anthropological. Presentations at three American Anthropological Association national conventions. My new book, Starstruck, is going to be published by an anthropology publishing company, as is another project that Doug and I are working on together, which isn't far enough along to give any real details. And I don't know which ones will succeed, but we've got programs in both humans in space and planetary defense proposed to the American Psychological Association. At least one of these has been accepted. So what I'm seeing from the SETI Institute and the SETI community is a real interest in space and one that's growing. And this is a true delight to see.
Now SETI has a new director, right, in Scott...
Scott Hubbard.
Scott Hubbard, yeah, thank you.
Scott Hubbard was, I believe...
From NASA Ames.
Chief at Ames. He is there in a particular endowed chair. I can't remember if it's the...
So he's not the director. I apologize for that, yes.
No, but he is there, and he's in an endowed position. We got to remember that the SETI Institute, despite the name, probably 80% of its work is in the more general area of astrobiology. And, Scott's been a tremendous supporter of this kind of thinking and work. I cannot tell you Scott's exact role. I think it's new, and I think he was just getting going when I was last there, which was in November.
As I mentioned when we started the show, Rusty Schweikert and Tom Jones were on about planetary defense and their benefit program at Chabot, which I went to, which was really, really cool. And the movie that they showed, Cosmic Collisions, from the American Museum of Natural History, is amazing, plus the sky charts that they turned on for us to show us the near-Earth orbits around Earth in this amazing way that they do it in a planetarium so that you're actually there. Was really compelling. So I understand the risk and the dangers and the science and the technology and all the things that they're working on for planetary defense. Now, tell me how, and tell the listeners how, astrosociology fits into planetary defense. Are you talking about evacuating people? What are we talking about here?
Well, I think one of the things that we need to consider, and it's something that people probably, a lot of people don't consider, is the fact that when we talk about protection, we need to protect society, and we need to protect culture, not just people. Because if you have individual survivors, and you don't have this, you know, and the culture is destroyed, then you're not going to be in the same shape that you would be in if, you know, than if you can save your culture and save your society in some way. So, you know, whether we're talking about shelters or whether we're talking about taking some of the resources that we're used to having in museums, for example, and putting them underground or whatever, we have to make decisions about, you know, how we're going to protect ourselves because, you know, it may happen 500 years from now or it may happen tomorrow, but it's something that will happen. So we need to decide how many resources we want to put into these.
So the planetary defense community, are they receptive to astrosociological issues?
Some are and some less so. But what's important is that there's a key group of people that are interested in this. And you see, they recognize the importance of these things because they know that political support for the activity is really crucial. One major effort is under the direction of Ivan Becky, who I think was a consultant to both, you know, for more than one Impact movie.
Right, I know Ivan.
We're putting together a project for the International Academy of Astronautics. I say we with me playing a very small role, but it does include chapters on people's behavior and on policy, and we try to look at a lot of different things like, you know, warning and what happens in these major disasters. How do people actually behave? How can we come up with ways to prepare people even through the disaster, help them recover, that you might say go with the grain of human nature rather than against it? And at the upcoming conference at George Washington University, there's a half-day session on astrosociology, you might say, and another half day on politics and policies and things. So it's an interest. You know, I mean, if I were a physicist who was interested in blowing up a asteroid or coming up with a new computer program, you know, I might not be as interested in the societal applications as certainly I am as a psychologist. But the you know, the effort as a whole includes this, and so it's very nice to see. What I found is that a lot of astronomers seem quite open to psychology for whatever reason. It's almost like a humanistic streak in many astronomers. Not all, but in many.
You know, at the Chabot event, and Rusty was making the major presentation and appeal. And I think you'll find this really interesting. They describe the technology and the engineering and the ideas that are out there to, in 2007, try to protect Earth and how these ideas might evolve. But then he talked about the focus of the astronauts group that was really the benefit of this event and how they're trying to get a treaty with the UN on how to deal with planetary defense, and they're going to have all of these conferences around the world, and hopefully they can come on with, you know, with some sort of a treaty. But what is the treaty addressing? Astrosociological issues. For example, they said, at what point do you want to interfere with an incoming NEO? Because depending on where you interfere, it may affect the United States, say Colorado, or it may affect a country in Central or South America that's very poor. Who pays for it? If you decide to take the hit, because it's likely not going to do that much damage. Who pays for the damage? Who pays to evacuate the people? Who makes a decision that says this country can absorb the hit and another country we will go and defend and move the asteroid away? So the treaty and all of the work that they're addressing comes down to not the engineering and the technology, but dealing with the societal issues of how to implement planetary protection and who makes the decisions to implement planetary protection.
Yeah, you have ethical concerns there.
Totally. And I thought, you know, I've never thought about this, but yeah, if they're going to have a world body protecting the world, they may say it's better to take a hit in the mountains of Colorado than to spend the money or to try to move it or do something else. But then whose responsibility is it for that? What if the United States has signed that treaty and doesn't want to take a hit in Colorado? Do they then throw the treaty away and act independently? And what are the society's issues for that? So all the technology boiled down to sociological issues in the end, which I thought was really fascinating.
Those people are just so wonderful, and it reminds me of the transformative effects of space travel, where people start thinking in terms of Earth as a whole, come back much more humanistic and concerned about such things than before they went up, I suspect. And that, but whatever, it seems to sort of accentuate that. And Rusty, I think, is, you know, whether it's living in space, human transformation, planetary defense, he always keeps popping up in these really interesting conferences and areas.
I wish you'd been at the Chabot event. It was really like going full circle when he talked about the obligations of the treaty to actually implement planetary protection, because up till then, everybody's focusing on science, engineering, technology, and now all of a sudden, here we are back to all of the human problems that we're dealing with, and it was a fascinating round trip.
You know, another issue is, you know, let's say you need to place equipment in different parts of the world to protect the Earth. Who's going to pay for some kind of defensive type of equipment in a poor country? Are the developed nations going to get together and fund it, or, you know, what's going to happen? So there's that kind of issue as well.
Absolutely.
And there are societies out there. I was reading an article the other day, and I'll decline to mention it, but it's a specific society, but that it's considered wrong to try to predict disasters because it's seen as a sort of a form of fortune telling, so therefore you don't try to predict such things. You know, this is very, very different from, you know, our view that we want to predict it so that we can intercept it or at least, you know, get prepared. Just letting it blow up somewhere, I think that, think of the consequences in terms of how that society would regard the rest of the world. I mean, my personal shoot from the hip view is that you have some kind of treaty and you abide by it, and it doesn't, you know, it's agreed in advance and it's done, and it doesn't even matter if it's some group you're hostile with. If this is something that has to be done to protect humanity as a whole.
Yeah, and, you know, especially if it's a civilization killer.
Yeah, it gets kind of scary. One of the things I did, and one of the things I wrote for Ivan, I'm waiting to have somebody tell me it has to come out, was I do have a couple of pages on establishing survival communities, and I compare these survival communities to communities on Mars. And, so it has a little bit of a science fiction overtone, but I think it's something that might be considered in the case of a really serious impact if we haven't been able to get off the planet yet. So we'll stay tuned to see what happens to it in this giant official document.
Absolutely. I have another question from Marshall. many people think that the mission to Mars will take at least 2 years. Before the government sends people to Mars, what kind of long-duration missions will have to be done to prove good long-term mental health of mission members? That's interesting. Will they do real missions or simulate, or what do you think they'll do?
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind is, okay, there's going to have to be some actual experience in space, but you know, one of the suggestions is you can do long-term simulations in a place like Antarctica. Now you can't simulate weightlessness there and stuff, but there's going to have to be some kind of testing, and you know, whether it's on the moon, whether it's on some kind of orbiting platform, laboratory, some combination. I will mention that I remember reading years ago that members of the British Antarctic Party at some point in their history would sign up for something like 5 years. So, you know, I don't have a straight answer, but I think there's a lot of possibilities, and certainly there's got to be some exploration of this. Now, David, you may know more about this, but I had heard reference to the idea of recently the Russians, they might be considering a trip around Mars in a small spaceship.
You know, there's been talk that since the Soyuz was originally designed to take people to the moon, that it could be refitted with the lunar heat shield and take people back to the moon. So there are people who say that they could sell a space tourist flight for $100 million or $120 million to orbit the moon. Now, I haven't heard the Russians say they want to do this. I would imagine that they would have to test this out and do a couple of flights with their cosmonauts before they took paying passengers on it, and they would have to resurrect their heat shield that would be capable of protecting them when they come back from the moon. So I guess it's in theory possible, but will the Russians reactivate the Soyuz lunar program and redevelop the heat shield that can sustain coming back from those speeds when they hit back in the Earth's atmosphere? I don't know. I haven't seen that yet. I just hear a lot of talk about it.
But what I had heard was actually Mars, unless I got it wrong. And I know that at one point in the 90s, one of the U.S. aerospace companies was considering proposing, you know, sending out a very small craft, maybe with only one person in it even. I don't remember the exact details. They talked to me about it. And it would just sort of go out and loop around Mars and come back. And they said, well, what do you think of it? And I think I gave them a two-word answer, which was not much.
Well, I don't think this
this is going to get resurrected at some point in Earth's history.
Yeah, I think it's the moon. I don't believe the Soyuz is capable of a mission of Mars.
Soyuz, it's not a very spacious and comfortable vehicle. It does the job, but if you ever see a mock-up, you know, you might not want to climb on board right away.
Being cosmonauts go crazy after a while, too. So.
I would have a real hard time.
Trip.
And if some recent jail fights that I've read about in the newspaper are any indication of what people can be like in real close confined quarters without windows, I would think a trip to the moon in a Soyuz without really disciplined, skilled, and focused people on board might be a recipe for total disaster. Not that they're criminals like people in jail, but I bet the sociological issues are not that different.
Psychological and sociological.
Yeah. And a jail cell is bigger than
the moon. I mean, the moon may be not so bad, because eventually you get to the moon pretty quickly.
Well, it'd be about a 10-day trip to and from, and that thing is really close quarters.
Yeah.
So if you're claustrophobic, you're not going to like it. But, you know, if you're claustrophobic, you're not going to make it anyway, because as soon as they put the spacesuit on you and close the faceplate, you're probably going to freak out. And that's going to happen here on Earth in the testing phase. And
yeah, they'll find out in training.
Uh-huh. And I think that that's one of the reasons why the space tourist, I forget his name, from Japan, was not able to go, is because he did have an issue in a tight situation and wearing the spacesuit. And, you know, psychologically, that would not be good, because, you know, you do have to use that spacesuit. And the Soyuz has had pressure problems coming back in where, you know, the spacesuit saves your life. So if you're going to freak out in a claustrophobic situation, better to stay on Earth. Gentlemen, do you want to give out email addresses for people to contact you, give you their thoughts and comments? Al, do you want to give yours out, or do you want them to go through me?
My email address is A.A. Harrison, all one word, A.A.H.A.R.R.I.S.O.N., at UC Davis, all one word, UCDAVIS.EDU.
And Jim, do you want to put yours out?
Yes, mine is JPASS, J-P-A-S-S, at astrosociology, all one word, .com.
Do you gentlemen have concluding remarks for our listeners today, pearls of wisdom, thoughts you'd like to leave with them?
I wanted to mention real quickly about the at the PSA conference that we're going to be showing Kathleen Connell's film. It's called The Legacy of Apollo, Enduring Gifts to Humanity. And we're going to have a discussion of astrosociological issues following that.
Where is this conference and when is it?
It's going to be, that's a good question. It's going to be in Oakland. Let me get to my
end of March.
Oh, really? Maybe I should go over across the bay and go to it. Is it open to the public?
Yeah, it is. You can look at the details on my calendar page of my site.
Okay. If I'm not at a meeting in Albuquerque, I'll go across the bay to it.
It's March 29th through April 1st.
Okay. Are you both going to be there for it?
Sorry?
Are both of you, Jim and Al, you're both going to be there?
I may not be there the whole time, but I'm planning on it.
Yeah, we need to coordinate that. I'd like Al to be at the film if we can arrange it.
Yeah, the film is great. And
I'm thinking just staying there. Well, my only comment is that it's great to be on the show again, and the questions that come in from the listeners are they're stimulating and valuable. And what I particularly enjoy is the interactive nature, rather than just sitting here reading another space book. You know?
I agree with
Thanks
that.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely, and when you're ready to release your upcoming book, let me know, and we'll bring you back on the show about that as well.
That would be great. I look forward to that. Thanks.
Okay, and on behalf of our guests today, Al and Jim, I want to thank everybody for listening to The Space Show, and I want to thank our guest, Al Harrison, and Jim Pass for returning to the program and being with us again today. Again, I want to direct everybody's attention to a 9:30 a.m. program with Dr. Sam Dinkin tomorrow, Wednesday, and then a 7 p.m. program with Richard Hoagland tomorrow evening. Thank you all for tuning into The Space Show, and we'll be back tomorrow morning, faithfully. Everybody have a good night. Stay warm. Thank you all.